And David put his hand in his bag, and took thence a stone, and slang it, and smote the Philistine in his forehead. The stone sunk into his forehead, and fell upon the face of the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Welcome back to Bookwave. We're looking at 1 Samuel today. I'm your host, Scott. Joined by Pat.
Hey.
Jason.
Good morning.
And William.
Howdy.
Well, if you're new around here, you should check out our website at www.bookwave.club. And today, in our next video of the Holy Bible Book Club, we're looking at 1 Samuel. And my question to you for a book that's pretty much known for the story of David and Goliath, what do you think was the most important or impactful part of the book other than that? Or which was the most important of the characters? Whoever wants to start, let's just jump right into it.
I think what Jason shared before we started recording was a really good quote talking about the first book of Samuel tells the story of Israel's transition from a theocracy to a monarchy. In Judges, we have the nation of Israel ruled by loosely affiliated tribes, priests, and religious heroes, which transitions to a centralized king under Saul. Samuel represents the old rule of the judges, Saul represents Israel's failed attempt at monarchy, and David represents God's ideal king. And so through that lens, it seems like a much more politically geared documentation of the history of these peoples and their battles to get to where they're going. So for me, that was the most important part.
And to go along with that, it kind of shows the differences between Samuel and Saul and their views of success. Because we have Samuel as the last judge in this one, and how he was governed by God to be the leader of the Israelites, and even God singling him out as a prophet too, like the first ever child prophet, and as he grows up, and we have Saul who shares initial success, but even with his resources, he still finds himself to be out of place, and he's very jealous of that. And from what I've gotten out of reading the first book of Samuel is how one takes their opportunities seriously and what they will do in the expenses of the lives among them. That's what I got out of this.
What I kind of got out, and just to recap the main characters, you know, we have God, of course, up in the sky. Samuel is, as you mentioned, Pat, the last judge. And this whole story is kind of an overarching narrative from that time where Israel's entered the land of Canaan, but they don't have a king. They have these priestly judges. And so this story starts very similar to what we saw in Genesis with Jacob and Rebekah. It's actually in the same place that Samuel is born that Rebekah is buried. And of course, we have Saul, who's kind of a person that the people wanted a king, but God is kind of in this paradox where he's saying that if you guys have a king, it's kind of rejecting my sovereignty as your Lord. And if you end up with a king, you're going to be tyrannized, possibly tyrannized. You could possibly become slaves to this king. And we see that Saul kind of puts himself up on a pedestal and does things that might be considered to not listening to God, and he asks forgiveness later. And then we also have David, who is supposed to be more in accordance with God's laws. So what I got out of it was this idea that, kind of going back to Deuteronomy, that if you don't follow the law, you're going to end up cursed, as we saw with Saul.
Hmm. And you guys kind of touched on it a little bit, but the main thing that stuck out to me was when, you know, the Bible refers to, you know, the sons of Eli and the other people that don't want a king as the sons of Belial, which we've talked about just means like bad opinion, not worth the opinion of the populace, whatever. And then at a certain point when a king is named, it refers to the sons of Belial as those who don't follow the word of the king that the people have chosen. So it seems like there's either someone changed their mind up there in the sky, or, you know, there's some of that wrestling with God going on that we've talked about. So I like to talk about a little bit to see if, Do you guys think if that's God changing his mind because of the people, or do you think it's all part of his big plan? And if there's like a little bit of a wrestling match going on here.
I think it's really interesting because in the desert with Moses and God, we saw them lay out tradition, ritual, ceremony, belief, ideals. And they also had this giant camp that they were constantly moving, and they were doing something. They had a thing that they had to do, and the way they did it, they honored God. And as they transitioned into this world where it wasn't just them and the wilderness and God, it was them and God and their walls and their societal structures and their economic structures, it isn't enough. And while it's nice to think that your religion can work for everyone, we enter into this power gap or this power vacuum where you need a ruler. And if your ruler isn't ruling with God, but simply ruling for the people and what they need, then you create that distance between those lessons. And it's this weird relationship that they now enter, and they're now trying to rectify and figure out what system is going to be enough for them to be able to govern their body of people and still worship God in this new terrain, in this new environment. And so they're trying on different systems. And that's really interesting, because obviously that's something we're still trying to figure out today. What is the right amount of proactive rule that allows people, when you're dealing with people, to fit in and do good?
Yeah, it also, like, the Bible doesn't explicitly say this, but, like, Asimov tracks some of this stuff, too, where, like, at certain time periods, there's multiple judges, and then eventually the amount of judges in the country gets lower and lower, and talks about Samuel having to travel between three different locations. He's like a traveling judge, judging over three different cities instead of just, you know, any of the other judges it talks about just staying in one place. So it could be like they needed one overarching judge that they just would be able to call a king and then do away with the old system instead of just having multiple guys setting up their own more libertarian establishments.
And it also comes down to numbers, how many people there are and what they can do. Because in the 8th chapter, there's a warning concerning how a king is going to rule. And this warning consists of how many people will be replaced and who will do most of the work and doing all the serving. And it says, so Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked of him a king. He said, this will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. You will take your sons and place them for himself, in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before the chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest, and to make his weapons of war and equipment of his chariots. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will also take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. And it goes on like that. So it's also just looking at a numbers game, essentially.
There's this idea, too, that how the king is going to rule in accordance or disaccordance with the law can be viewed on an individual basis of how are you going to rule your own life? What procedures are you going to follow, you know, whether it be a daily discipline or, you know, what things or events in your life are you going to make ceremonious and what laws are you going to follow? Because if you don't, your individual story could be very similar to what is described as Saul's failing. You know, if you don't have discipline, you're going to end up failing because you don't have a target to aim for or hit. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's the whole thing. And that's the distinction between Saul and David, right? Like Saul is saying, okay, well, there's problems. Let's solve them. And then David is saying, what's the plan? Like, what's the master plan? Where are we going and how do we get there? Because I can't see the big picture. And what I do see isn't enough data for me to make decisions. And he turns to God and he gets those answers. And maybe God isn't the appropriate thing for us to turn to these days, but maybe it is. Who knows? But certainly we need to look beyond the circumstances of the now and accept the fact that there are some big picture things that are beyond our basic grasp. And if we don't start paying attention to those mechanisms, we're not going to be able to perpetuate and sustain ourselves. And I don't think God's the guy who has the answers, because I am a human and I don't understand the concept.
Well, yeah, I mean, plus he works in mysterious and humorous ways, so he's unpredictable.
And people replace the idea of God with the eye at the top of the pyramid or the highest goal you can imagine, or even your future self that you want to become. So if you're not living towards that future self, your current self is going to end up what you might think is cursed, like the curses we saw numbered in Deuteronomy.
And even more than that, like if you're still caught up in, you know, anger or rage or jealousy or insecurity, you can't even see the opportunity that might be in front of you. Like, especially in the case of Saul and David, where it's like, if you truly wanted the best for your people, you would be able to step aside because you're doing this too emotionally and you're not appointed by God. And David is appointed by God and he's going to rule the people. And theoretically, if you love God and you love your people, then you'd let that happen. But we get attached to our emotions and to our perceptions of reality, and we let something get in the way of us being authentic and sincere.
Okay, I want to jump off that thing that gets in the way, and try to tie that into God's relationship with King Saul, because God seems like he's begrudgingly anointing Saul as the designated king. But
yeah, it's like Samuel makes too many excuses for him, and God's just like, okay, fine. Jeez, you want a king? Take him.
Which is, It's interesting because I have this theory that doing something terrible is much worse than doing nothing at all. And if you look at it simply as, well, they need a king and they seem to be pretty hung up on that reality and they don't want to see a choice, let's just give them Saul so that Saul can demonstrate to the people that we need a king and this one's lacking. And as soon as you know what it isn't that you want, you can get closer to what it is that you want. But if you just sit around saying, well, he's not right, well, he's not right, well, he's not right, then
Yeah.
you haven't made a choice.
It's easier to find a good king when you know what a bad king looks like. Give them a bad example so they know what not to aim at.
And that makes perfect sense. That aligns with God's mysterious ways and plans.
Okay,
Fair enough.
speaking of the mysterious ways, chapter 16, verse 7. It said that people look at the outward appearances, but the Lord looks at somebody's heart, right? Occasionally, though, the Lord is said to harden somebody's heart. So, in this case of Saul, did the Lord know ahead of time that Saul may not have been the best choice, but picked him anyway? Or did he pick him and then harden Saul's heart after he disobeyed the Lord?
I think it was like a quantum decision. I think Saul was and wasn't the right choice, and that because he wasn't, that's what made him the right choice.
Like some kind of 4D chess move.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, so you need to make this guy king, and it will harden his heart because he will be a human who doesn't see the point. And that's okay because there will be thousands of people who do. And they will be upset, and that will cause them to look for something better. And if we just like we have to make action, because you can't actualize God's plan without taking the first step. And if we think about that slideshow that Jordan Peterson has, where it's like you want to get to here, you're here, you shoot for there, and you land over here, and then you discover that over here is actually over here, and then you try and adjust and you aim, and it's like you get this constant series of steps that get closer to where you want to go, but you would never even know where you actually wanted to go if you didn't take that first step. And I think Saul is that first step.
But
And I like that.
just like in quantum physics, if there is a God actually orchestrating all of this thing, he's gonna be able to see the trajectory of like that moving target, just like a solar system. Like we might not be able to just tell where the sun or where Venus is gonna be like tomorrow or in 48 hours, but you know, if you actually see the projection and see the pattern, then you know, he would obviously know that Saul is going to be the biggest teaching tool for these Jews or Israelites.
You know, it's like this metaphysical, like highest level Sicilian defense chess game, where it's like you say Sicilian defense to someone who thinks they know chess, and they're like, sorry, what? And it's like, yeah, did you know that there are books on this stuff, and there are algorithms, and there are only so many choices you can make, and my choices will make you make choices, and then your choices will allow me to make more choices? It's like, huh? I just wanted to move my pawn forward two spaces. Yeah, it's okay. Pat you on the head.
I like chess, but that's too extreme for me.
So
We
this
just.
quantum analogy is really good in terms to you are both your future self and not your future self. Because the actions you take when you're experiencing the present moment are going to influence the trajectory of your future self. So, for example, if you are doing something stupid, let's say you're going 120 miles an hour on a Ducati Monster, you can kind of feel this like uncertainty in your reality or the holographic possibility of your future self. It becomes less certain. Or if you do things that aren't in your best interest or not in the best interest of people you love around you, that's going to influence the trajectory of your future possibilities.
And it's good data, right? Like making mistakes, if you can consider the outcomes, are fantastic. Some of the best things I've ever done like in hindsight, I wish I hadn't have had to do. But because I went down that road, I learned what that street looks like. And I said, no, I don't want to buy in here. I want to actually go back up the road and take a right now. Because for me, I had to experience negative outcomes to appreciate their worth. And for me, it was like, how bad is bad? And if there's so many people doing bad in this world, don't they know it's bad? Aren't they not happy? And it's like, I had to go down to that room to find out that no, they do know it's bad and they're trapped. But for me, I wasn't trapped. It was just a soul exploration for me. And it was like, okay, now I'm going to go back up and I'm going to try and do better. But I don't know if I could have ever done better before doing bad. And then we
Yeah.
start talking about the Tao.
Yeah. Like they say in any hobby or practicing any art, just aim to fail and then you learn from there.
Yeah. And it's like, hopefully you know that you're failing too.
Yeah. Then comes the detaching and the analyzing and, you know, the meditation, actually trying to improve, putting the effort out. That's important.
Well, when I was growing up as a rambunctious teenager, I thought no matter what path I took, that I had this wide boulevard that I could just coast down life on. And you hear all the adults that are wise telling you, you have to walk the narrow path, because if you don't, the possibility of where you're going to end up later in life is less certain. And you can't tell until you get to that later point in life through retrospect of realizing, oh, I should have been on a narrower path.
Yeah, definitely. So Scott, tell us about the foreskins found. You said you found something interesting in, what is it, chapter 18?
Yeah, it was
Remember, guys, if
chapter.
you like hearing about foreskins, you can check out more of our podcasts at bookwave.club, anchor.fm/bookwave, YouTube.
Check out some more readings,
Wow.
some musings that we found.
Oh yeah, I don't know if I should go into my notes or from the book here. Oh yeah, so Saul and David, they decide they're going to be, you know, they're going to acquaint themselves with each other, and Saul wants a dowry gift so David can, you know, marry his daughter. And he doesn't want any dowry gift except for 100 Philistine foreskins. So, you know, David rounds up his posse, goes out, slays some Philistines, 200 of them actually, and
Overachiever.
he gathers them up. He really likes this girl, man. So
Does she
he
have a
kills
sister?
them first. Well, yes, he circumcises the corpses effectively. So
Pure dedication.
I don't think that helps you with the whole covenant and getting you into the whole goods with God and everything, but you know, he got their foreskins to prove that he went after them. Saul was like, good job, I'm gonna give you this other daughter that, you know, you didn't want actually, but she's gonna be your wife. So right off the bat, they don't have a good relationship.
I was trying to imagine how that interaction went down, where he brings back the 200 hoodies of the giggle sticks and he counts them out. I mean, that, like, what is Saul's, I mean, was this just a test of obedience? And hopefully Saul thought, well, maybe this will obviously get David killed. He's not going to come back from this.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, but like I'm not sure if this is before or after the whole like everyone writes that song about them, like Saul has slayed his thousands and David has tens of thousands. So like there's already some bitterness there, like I'll get my revenge on him, I'll get him killed.
Well, I think Saul is also upset that God was mad at him because so God tells him to go and kill all of these Amalekites, the women, the children,
Right.
everything. And they do that for the most part, but they take the king alive and they take some of the best animals for sacrifice. And he thinks that that's a good
Right.
thing, even though this is ultimately the thing that does him in, that puts him in disgrace with God. Because it seems like on the surface, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like God wants people to obey him to the T. And if you don't, you're out.
Well, I also think like the whole God of jealousy thing plays into it too. Like, why are you worshiping this man instead of me? And I think the reason that David makes such a better king is 'cause he doesn't say, "Hey, don't worship me. There's still a God in this guy, you know. He's the one taking care of us. I'm just speaking for him," kind of thing. Instead of Saul saying, "You know, I'm the king. I get all the women, I get all the good stuff. I can order this guy to kill 100 Philistines just for the fun of it. Could do what I want. I'm the king." Whereas David takes more of a responsibility and tries to act more in accordance with, you know, the laws of Moses and everything else.
And I don't know if that is what does Saul in. So if we look at like the Deuteronomic code, it says that if you don't follow the law, you will be cursed. If you follow it, you'll be blessed. And one of the curses is madness and confusion of the mind. So my question is like, is was Saul air quotes mad before he disobeyed God, or was that actually a curse that God put on him? And it says that God gave or afflicted Saul with a demon, which I thought was kind of weird. How, what does God have like a I don't know, a collection of demons he consorts with?
Yeah, well, whenever I see the word demon in the Bible, I remember that, you know, the King James Version was translated from the Septuagint, which was the Greek translation. So we know the Hebrews weren't talking about demons the same way the Greeks were talking about demons. And I don't know, it's hard to talk about demons these days without dipping into the esoteric, like, tiny little black imps with red eyes. Like, that's definitely not how I see a demon at all. Like, when I think of a demon, it's like we were talking about the other day, like problems with addiction or like post-traumatic stress or some kind of trauma like that. That's what I consider to be a demon for the way like the Greeks really intended it, not like this extra spiritual force. I think a lot of that is just kind of anthropomorphizing aspects of nature and the human psyche as external aspects of the universe and just starting to call them demons.
Well,
It's
it's all about comparison and contrast, essentially.
for me, like the way I see it, it's like demons can be that big, right? Like they can be PTSD and just general trauma and big incidents in your life, but they can be smaller stuff too, right? Like your demons are your anger and your fear and your insecurities. And I think that it's interesting when you start talking about demons 2,000, 3,000 years ago, because there is a certain level of understanding and awareness you have to have in order to feel that you've done the wrong thing. And every man and woman and child on this planet that has gotten to a certain point in their life knows that there's something they need to do that they've been avoiding doing that they wish they didn't do, or they know that they've done wrong. And I think it's still also this extra spiritual force that when you've done the wrong thing, when you've acted out of impulse, when you've reacted, when you've fed into your ego, it hurts and it haunts you. And I don't know which came first, and I don't really care, but I think that when you, in Saul's case, don't act out of the will of God, you know you're doing wrong. And it's going to take a heck of a lot more mental agility to make you consciously feel like you're doing right in a society that believes that what you're doing is wrong. And that would cause madness. That's where we get splits. When you know what's right, but you disagree consciously and do something fundamentally against your nature, it's maddening.
And that goes back to the question from earlier, is what is right? What is the right system? And yet we don't have that yet.
No, but what we do have is reality, and we have emotions and logic and consideration. And when we don't weigh the four of those with balance, we get wrong. And right is contextual, as far as I'm concerned. And when you shrink the context and you decrease the amount of members that are available to contribute their reality and their opinion, you're more likely to make mistakes. That's why cults fail, because they exclude the rest of the world. And if it doesn't work for the rest of the world, then it doesn't really work at all.
Sounds almost like you're poking holes through objectivism too with that kind of talk.
I might be. Give me another 15 years and I'll definitively tell you my opinion. But I think because it's weird too, right? Like even 150, 250 years ago, we were dealing with the problem of voter rights. And it's like, who deserves to vote? Well, an informed citizen. But who makes an informed citizen? Well, government. Well, how do you make government informed citizens? Well, you get citizens involved. And it's like this vicious, destructive circle where government's not enough and religion's too much and people still exist. And it's like, you need to be able to get people to the table. But if you can't get them to the table, what do you do with people? And it's like, well, you do better. And that's a big, daunting task, but damn it, it's necessary.
Will, when you were talking about when you do what is, you know, to be wrong, and you end up more chaotic from doing so, it kind of reminds me of the narrow path we were talking about. If you fall off, you're either going to fall into the abyss and perish, or you're going to maybe climb up the walls of the path back towards your future. And that is not a trivial matter. It's difficult.
No, I'd say it takes at least twice as many steps to get back to the path as it does to get off of it. But it's hard. Like, we need to do a lot more reading because I don't have enough information, and it's just, there's so much. But I'll tell you right now, anything that can be interpreted negatively is negative.
Yeah.
So everything is negative?
No.
What are you really saying there? Everything can be interpreted as a negative or a positive if you're optimistic or pessimistic enough. So it's all through the filter.
I think that filters are pretty destructive, but that if you boil it down, you know, sharing food with someone who's hungry is really hard to interpret as a negative thing.
It might be negative if, you know, you're giving it to a homeless person when your starving wife and children are at home. Then you're giving away everything. Then you're on the wrong side of the golden mean. That's what Aristotle talks about, if we're going to dip our toes back into objectivism again.
Well, and it's like you'd be better off teaching a man to fish than giving him fish. But if you don't have the means to teach him to fish and there's no river available, but you do own a supermarket, maybe you could give him some fish. And maybe if he has energy in his belly, he'll be able to pick up a fishing rod. And maybe if everybody got involved with the same mentality and said, look, people need fish, then we could all get to a place where we could distribute food equally. But again, it's so hard, especially when there's so many people that haven't gotten to the page that we're so blessed to be able to be on, which is having access to Google in our language. You know, having the ability to read ancient texts and sacred texts and study. Like, there are so many places on this planet that still can't do what we're doing, that it isn't even okay to discuss the things that we discuss. And there's so much work that needs to be done. And it's Yeah, totally. You can interpret things poorly all the time, but man, there's something higher. I don't know. I'm only 26.
And one of the things I found that makes it more difficult to be compassionate and help other people is when you start seeing other people as not humans, and rather you see them as the decisions they've made. So if they've made a mistake and you characterize them by the mistakes they've made instead of saying, you know, you're a human person that's made a mistake, you see them as you are a mistake of a human, it makes it very difficult to want to help them out. Let's say, for example, somebody voted for the wrong person in a political election. Sure, they may have made a mistake to you, but they as a whole are not what they voted for.
No, and that's one of the really wrong philosophies that I've seen in the sort of self-help movement. One of these things that I think is becoming more and more fringe is the whole past behaviors are the best determiners of future behaviors. And it's like, no, you're dead wrong. Like, what you've done isn't who you are. How you've done it isn't who you are. And the choices that you make today don't have to be influenced by anything beyond how great you want to make things. And it makes it hard, right? Like, because if you look at, say, the worst, rape, theft, murder, how do you deal with those people? Well, I don't know. I'm only 26, but I'm pretty sure they could do a bit more, and we could probably create a system that allowed them to contribute and actually rehabilitate, because that's what we're pretending that we're doing with them. But I don't see it actually having the benefits on society, and I see it being considered a detriment to the world economy, having a very large prison population. And it's like, but people don't want them in our community. What do you do with pedophiles? And it's like, they can lift a hammer, can't they?
Well, I would say you have to listen and understand where they got to that mistake. What led them to that mistake, I should say. And what they were thinking at the time. And then you compare that to where they are now and you ask, okay, well, what do you want to do in the future without associating with that mistake you've made in the past?
Yeah, if you just shun them and treat them like a monster, they are going to become even a more fierce. It's a really challenging thing to show compassion to somebody who seen do something terrible, let's say a pedophile or a rapist. But until you really open up the possibility that they could be a fully functional, integrated person, they're not going to ever have that opportunity. You have to kind of help guide them to what their full potential could be if they stop doing things that harm themselves and others.
Yeah, it reminds me of I think integration is key there. It reminds me of a line from one of my favorite movies. Of course, it's a Batman movie, Dark Knight. There's a point where Bruce Wayne is, being a drunken billionaire, playboy, philanthropist, and all that, out with like two bimbos, and then he sees Rachel, like his child love, and he says, this isn't me. This isn't who I am. And she says, oh, Bruce, it's not who you are underneath. It's what you do that defines you. So, like, you kind of have to, you can't just have your core self down, like, just buried beneath everything else and say, I'm actually a good guy. I just have to do all of this stuff to keep up with appearances, because, like, it really works both ways.
Well, and that's like that sort of personal philosophy to the exclusion of reality. And we saw that in Francisco D'Anconia, right? In Atlas Shrugged, where he postured himself at the like public image level for people to believe that he was a vagrant and useless and wasting his money. And then behind that, he had his own plan that excluded everybody who had an opinion of him. And he didn't care what people thought of him. And in fact, he insisted that people thought of him that way so that he could have the freedom to do what he actually did. And it's like, that's not good either, because you think you're doing good, but you're not sharing it with the world. And in fact, you're running away from the world. And it's very easy to run away from the world. And it takes a heck of a lot more effort to look at the problems and say, what if you just modeled the wrong behaviors at a very young age? And what if you never turned around and said, this isn't who I am, and I have these dreams and hopes and wishes of who I could be, and what I need is tools and support. But it's so easy in today's society to just create your cave and dream about the man you never are and not do the things that make you the man you wish you could be.
And to bounce off that idea, if you're out there and you're asking yourself, or telling yourself that you need help, if you go and search for other people in the goal of getting help, I mean, from my experience, people are more than willing to lend a hand and help you out, especially those that your family. But if you don't have family, you can go find support groups. And there are people out there that'll help you out, but you have to be willing to ask for it.
And there has to be the opportunities there, like I don't know what opportunities exist outside of North America because I live in this bubble of this continent. I've been led to believe that there isn't as many opportunities in worse places, and that's devastating. And it would be so great to be able to bring the opportunities to those places, but there's already so much work to do here. There's so many people that are playing with psychosis and playing with sociopathy because they've decided that their logic or their emotions are the answer and that they need to be pissed off and that they need to take enraged action or that they need to exclude society's opinions and do whatever they think is right and not even listen to the news and not even pay attention to the circumstances. And it's like, I see where they're coming from. And it sucks that that's where they're going because they're not looking at the big picture.
Speaking of psychiatric afflictions, I tried to do a little basic psychoanalysis of King Saul from the story, and the conclusions that I came to were either that he suffered from either epilepsy, which is known as the holy disease, as you see colors and kind of have these weird hallucinations. Or that possibly he was bipolar, which, I mean, in the story, he kind of flipped between being very hostile to emphatically encouraging of David, where, he was like, here, go do this and I'll give you a wife. But at the same time, he's like throwing spears at him and like raving like a lunatic at the dinner table. What do you guys think about that? As far as like, did this king like suffer a psychiatric affliction? And if so, would that have made him the first principal character in the Bible that suffered like that?
Well, and that's one of the big things, right? Like when you give power and leadership to a human, it's so hard for it not to corrupt you. And that's maybe one of our first examples of the psychological impacts of being a king, where it's like, you can look at any system and say it looks great on paper, but what happens when a human who doesn't know the impact of the position is in that role? Because we didn't have the tools then to be like, hey man, this power is going to be enticing, intoxicating, and destructive. And it is going to be so easy for you to either be incredible or terrible. And if we don't even know that because we've never had a king before, then we're going to have to fail a couple times before we even learn that lesson. Like, what are we at? 100 years of knowing that we have a brain?
Yeah, and
So,
also the fact that it's like balancing an egg, power and all that. You just have to be very careful with it. It looks enticing, but it has severe consequences if you do not keep it in check. And it is very attractive, too. But how much responsibility are you going to take when you have that position? It's like it's one of the hardest jobs you could ever have, maintaining power.
Is
And it's
sorry, go ahead.
like that egg that you're balancing will one day balance you. And if you don't even understand that, then you shouldn't even be picking up the spoon.
Ooh, I like that analogy. Is Donald Trump the modern day King Saul?
Oh boy.
Here's where half of our subscribers take off. No.
It's okay, they didn't make it this far anyways. I would
Do you guys?
argue that I haven't read enough stories of enough leaders to accurately put Trump into a box.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we could easily talk about the effects of Trump having the same effects as Saul did. It would be harder to compare Trump himself to Saul himself, I
Yeah,
would
and I was
say.
just talking more like on a superficial level, of kind of somebody who's putting themselves up on a pedestal, seeing themselves as a powerful person, but might not necessarily understand the interconnectedness of everything and how their power is influencing, affecting other people.
Maybe I'd agree with you. Maybe I see it. 'Cause it's like he is a leader in a time of circumstance, as most are. And depending on the vision, when that's the whole thing, that supervision, you're supposed to be high enough up to see the playing field. But even if you just look at the one of the first things that caused controversy, it was the walls, right? Like he wanted to shut down his vision to this continent in a age where we've played that script so many times, where we've pretended that, if we can just fix our homeland, maybe we can spread that greatness to the world. And it's like, no, like there's problems in the world, and it is our homeland, and we are all humans, and we need to do something that's good for everybody. And there's a whole bunch of variables and limiting factors, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be grappling with those problems. And for Trump, I saw him wanting to do the wall thing, wanting to cut down on immigration and illegals. And it's like, you don't have the tools or the supervision to see the greatness that you could create because you're stuck with the problems that you have. And if someone had the insight to see the bigger game and to be able to get all of the players to the game, then maybe they could create something great. But we have so much greed and so much ego in this world now, when you look at, big corporations that are pulling the strings. Like the whole notion of lobbying is the most disheartening and flattening thing that I can consider right now.
And just to play devil's advocate for a bit, like you could say, like, to make Donald Trump's case, like, how are you gonna help all these other countries in other parts of the world if, your own country is sick and dying and, riots in the street, civil war on the horizon, all that business? Like, but in a way, I kind of, the one parallel that I would really like to see for Trump and Saul is a notion of something different around the corner. Like this is something brand new. Like Trump, like him or hate him, love him or despise him, don't really care. Just in Canada, enjoying the show. Like this is something different. Like at least he's gotten people into politics. Like you're either gonna take the red pill or go crazy, or you're gonna have to pick a path in this whole political sphere, one point or another, if you have Trump on your radar. So, in the same way that Trump is involving everybody in politics, Saul kind of did the same thing and paved the way for, a King David type character to take his place. Because we'd also have to consider, what if we got the perfect president, the perfect prime minister, the perfect ruler, and we didn't have the ability to appreciate them? Like, we need the Donald Trumps and the Joe Bidens to say, what is going on down there, before we can say, okay, now we have a genuine King David that's going to clean a bit of this stuff up and make us realize that a lot of our problems, it's on us. The president, prime minister can't do anything about it.
Yeah, I think what was going on in this story of First Samuel is the crazy stuff that King Saul was doing kind of woke up the populace. And I think we're seeing something similar by the time this podcast is aired. We may have an answer to, who's going to be that. I don't want to say king, because in the US we don't have a king, but who's going to be that leader? Because on November 3rd, people are going to decide, and a lot of people have been woken up. A lot of people are out there voting.
Yeah. It seems like every year it's the same thing. Like, oh, this is the big one. But I mean, this is the biggest big one I've ever seen. Especially for you guys down in the south.
Yeah.
Well, and we'll probably hopefully keep seeing bigger and bigger, right? Like,
Yeah.
it's like I go back to the knowledge and awareness thing, because we are so young on our planet. It is
Yeah.
ridiculous. And I've seen so many belief systems built on the failing presupposition that we have figured it all out and that we have learned enough to provide the true right answers. And it's like, there's no freaking way.
Just no
There just
way.
isn't. But
That's so
every
funny.
year we get to tackle bigger problems. And one of the big things that I always hear is like, oh, well, there's millions of children starving. And I was like, wow, I wonder how many millions of children were starving 25,000 years ago. We must have improved our resources and infrastructure so heavily to be able to support 30 million starving children compared to just throwing them in a pit. Like, get some perspective.
Like, you think human sacrifice is bad, right? Well, have some appreciation, have some gratitude.
Yeah.
It's cynical to say that, right? Like, obviously things were worse. Everybody knows that, but they don't. They really don't. And I think we need a reminder. And I think that we always create our own reminders. And I think that's what Trump is.
And it sounds too much from the outside, like, oh, you're just making excuses. Things can get better, right? Well, of course things can progress, but there's the whole Jordan Peterson throwing the baby out with the bathwater analogy. It's not good for us.
Yeah, burning the city down with the people that are making the wrong laws. Like, the city's nice, right?
Yeah, someone built that. That's architecture.
Speaking of better and worse, why, and kind of going back to the Bible chapter we're reading, what was it about these Amalekites kind of near like a third of the way through? Why is Saul even killing all these Amalekites? Were they just horrible people? Were they like sacrificing children and worshiping idols? Is that why God wanted them
Yeah, I think they
gone?
were just another group of pagans.
Okay. There
Weren't they
was a
giants
really.
too?
Yeah, they had giants, but like, again, it depends how you interpret giants. Like, were the giants the members of the Amalekites that they presented forward as their heroes, or were they 9 feet tall? Like, going back to David and Goliath here, it shows him as like over 9 feet tall. I forget what the exact measurement was that they
And there
used.
were some people who said that Goliath was somebody who may have had giganticism, like the genetic disorder.
Yeah, we
His
talked
sight
about
may have
that.
been blurry.
Yeah, we talked about that in the one of our previous videos, I think. And then you brought up that it was all in a TED talk. But I was talking to Tim. He was on one of our wave casts, and he pretty much made that case to me that, well, he obviously just had gigantism, because there's the line in the Bible that said that David came forth with staves and he had two rods in his hand, but in reality he only had one. So, he was seeing double, and that's another quality of giganticism. So there's so many clues that say he was just an abnormally large person. But it's hard to say if it's ever referring to the community as giants, or they're putting forward the giants as their heroes to be the fighters in single combat. And Isaac Asimov talks about that, like, at length, being, just like story device kind of thing. Like, Asimov and like the skeptics and the scientific crowd and the atheists always love to bring up the whole George Washington and the cherry tree story when comparing it to the Bible. Like, we know that this story isn't true, but it's a great story, so it's poetry, it's prose, it's beautiful imagery, so it gets kept in the canon, and eventually just kept kinda getting confused. Like the story of Ruth, the Jews considered it strictly literature, whereas the Christians consider it history because it includes one of the ancestors of Jesus Christ, so they feel it has more validity. But yeah, it's, I don't know. There's too much analysis. Like Will says, I'm only 28. I don't have all the answers, but I got a couple questions.
Speaking of prose, there was one really awesome line I thought that Samuel delivered after Saul had captured the Amalekite king. And this line made me think of Saul, like he, in the same way that like Samuel L. Jackson might deliver a line, he's standing by the king and he says, "Your sword has made widows of many people. And now with your head, I will make your mother a widow."
Oh,
And I
that's metal.
paraphrased it a little bit.
Actually, to go back to the example of Trump, there's another part of, I think it's in chapter 26, where David decides to spare Saul for a second time. And I'm thinking David could have just killed Saul for just messing up and everything and taking it too far.
Yeah, isn't
He could
that the
have, he
part in the
could.
cave where he like cuts his clothes and says like, "Hey, look what I was able to do to
Yeah, I mean, he could have just done that. But then again, going back to this idea of being a king, sure, you can get rid of the people that are causing the most harm among your populace. But you also have to remember why you are a king, following God's orders, God's laws, and that is principles. And we may see a lot of problems in the world that we want to be able to fix, and there are some problems here in our country, but it kind of goes into this barrier of you can't fix everything. You have to continue to follow the principles that you have sworn to follow. And if you don't have them written on a plaque for you to look at every day, you will wander aimlessly and not understand what you have done in order to put you in the position that you are currently in.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go around burning things down just because you disagree with them. Is that kind of what you're saying? Like, we see a lot of protests, maybe against police brutality, but then answer or the solution is get rid of all the police, burn it all to the ground. And I disagree with that. That would be equivalent to David just killing King Saul. That would be a violation of one of the Ten Commandments.
Right.
Yeah.
That is a good analogy. You know, some cops are corrupt, so abolish the police force. Oh, the king is corrupt, abolish the role of king.
Oh, oil damages the environment. Let's just burn the pipelines.
Jeez.
Well, and it's like, so in Atlas Shrugged, there's this quote in Atlantis. Spoilers.
Check out our check out Scott and Will's analysis of the book on
Yeah, it's a
Atlas,
good,
on our
good
channel.
book. Highly recommend it. There's this quote. It says, "I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine." And I think that on the surface level, it's a very anti-communist statement. But if you dig a bit deeper, personally, like I think that if you starve children, you're preventing your own growth. Because what if they cured, what if they would have cured cancer? What if they would have got us to Mars? And it's like, I don't think that we should live for other people. I think we should live for ourselves, and that includes other people. And,
Yeah.
you know, the notion of family needs to be expanded to community, and the notion of community needs to be expanded to world, and the notion of human needs to come back. Because
Yeah.
we have so many things that divide us, whether it's race, religion, country lines, you name it, pick a thing and it divides us, political preference. And it's like, well, that's not the answer. And we should have different opinions and we should be able to come together and reason and debate and grow and be able to do better, which I think we have by and large done for the past few thousand years. I don't think it looks as good as it could look, but I think that that very sentiment is the same thing that I have with the school system. And I think the school system's greatest lesson it taught me was that it could have done more. But if you don't have the awareness of the problem, you'll never be able to get the awareness of the solution. But when you get lost in conversations of problems, you don't see that there is a solution. Like, oh, there's too many carbon emissions. It's like, okay, yeah, sure, we could stop carbon emissions, or we could find out how carbon emissions could benefit us, like they're doing in Vancouver. I believe there's a company that's injecting carbon emissions into concrete, and it's making the density of concrete so much more dense that it's got a much longer life expectancy. And I will not be surprised in 50 years when I see that there is a minimum required carbon output for a human because we need more carbon emissions because it's so handy to have carbon emissions because we can extract them from the environment and turn them into buildings and engines and diamonds. But if we constantly look at it as saying, oh, we're destroying the environment, it's like, what about the conversation where we can save the environment?
Yeah, that
That
reminds me a
that's
lot of
a
that one video that you sent me recently, that 3-hour Facebook Live podcast analyzing Atlas Shrugged. And like the two guys that were talking about it, they were both Christian and they raised a really good point towards the end of it where they said that, you know, how do you think Ayn Rand's philosophy might have changed if she had children? Because when you look at the book of Atlas Shrugged, there's no kids. None of the main characters have started a family. Like when you see all of the villains in the book, like the one-dimensional communists, they all have a family and they're all like looking after each other. But like Hank Reardon, Francisco D'Anconia, Dagny Taggart, none of them have any kids. Like Hank has his like little brother that he treats as a child, but he completely neglects him. Doesn't care about his family at all. So, like, just on that point alone, you can see that Ayn Rand was missing a piece of the puzzle.
It's interesting you bring that up because I was having a conversation last weekend with a friend about how our society has drifted so far from the ritual boys into men sort of thing, that
Right.
structure. We've lost it. And I'm saying to my friend, like, we need to go back to that. We need to give rituals to young men to become real men. We need children to be able to become adults. And he said, no, no, no. That's where you're fundamentally making a mistake, because that's regressive. And if we go back to believing that there's a distinction between kids and adults, we'll be stuck with the distinction between kids and adults. And it's like, no, we have to transcend that. There are humans. And what a human needs at different stages of life changes, of course. But that doesn't mean we need to pretend that there's any distinction between kids and adults, because anybody that's been traumatized can tell you that age is not the depending factor on maturity. It is trauma or experience. And if you get enough trauma by the age of six, you wake up, you just wake up. And the whole notion of kids and adults, it falls out, and it's right and wrong. And when I was a kid, I needed structure, and I didn't get it the way I would have liked. Right. And I knew that then. And obviously we need structure, but this whole, every time you see a politician say, think about the children, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to stop listening to you because you don't even get it.
Yeah. Then you listen to Jordan Peterson talk about children. I'm like, yes. And like, it moves him to tears when he talks about like all of these kids, they're just aching for a little bit of structure in their lives.
Of course.
Well, of course. Well, obviously.
The difference, as I see, is that of competence. You know, a child and an adult are going to have different abilities. And we should treat them based on their competencies. And if they need assistance in one area, we can help them. But one thing I wanted to kind of bounce off, Will, where you were talking about problems in societies, individual problems versus kind of finding problems everywhere, like a sea of chaos. In terms of individual problems, we can describe it in terms of physics. You know, there's tensions. And the beautiful thing there is in physics, if you have a tension, you can create a solution to that tension for an individual problem. But if you are seeing everything as a problem, it's just chaos and there's no tension in that system. It's just an amorphous kind of globule of reality chaos. I mean, you're going to get lost.
Well, it's a good thing we have the antidote to chaos from Jordan Peterson, right?
Well, and it's interesting too, because if you talk about systems, an unstable system seeks to stabilize itself. That is the nature of systems. They, bearing in mind all the forces at play, they will stabilize themselves. And that doesn't mean that it's a good stability. You can have a stable system that is chaotic, which is the world at large. When you look at it, you know, you have so many variables that you need to have variables to classify your variables. But it's like, it's stable, obviously, because we haven't blown up the planet, but there's things that we notice in that system that we don't really like. And the only way we can change that is to add to it, because you can't just say, oh, well, you know, murder's a problem. Let's start a war on murder. It's like, no, you need to create a system that makes the old system obsolete. Like I said, I think yesterday, right? That Buckminster Fuller quote, where it's like, if you attack the problem for the problem's sake, you're just going to breed more problems. And look at every single like meta war that we've had, the war on drugs, the war on opiates, the war on violence, the war on communism, the war on anything, right? Every time you resist something, all you do is you get more of it. And it's like, and that's what I say about everything. Like, if you don't like a thing that you're doing, find out why you're doing it and come up with a better way to address that, and then add that to your life. Don't even try and get rid of it. Just add so much greatness to your life that the badness just falls off the table.
Yeah. Did you all want to talk about Saul's death? Because that seems to ring some resonance to the conversation we have.
Or do what you just want to wrap specifically?
Well, when I read about Saul's death, it just kind of goes back to complete full circle about him living his own life as this, as somebody who is very like envious and everything, and he hasn't taken the time to look at his life as a whole before he was slain in the next battle, right after Samuel's death. And I looked at that and I thought, well, how do you face death when, how should I say this? How do you see yourself as a whole before you come to terms with your own death?
I mean, he took his own life, though,
Yeah, he
correct?
did.
So.
When when Samuel gave the premonition of his death, that he was going to be slain in battle, but he chose to opt out and take his own life. Yeah.
I saw it kind of as a weakness of his character that he. I mean, could you say that the way he killed himself would be like the warrior's death? Or would that have been going and facing his enemy? Because he kind of just took his own life.
I think it's a parallel to I think something in the Book of Judges where I think his name was Abimelech or something like that, and he was the one that was going to die on the battlefield because like a woman struck him down, and then he killed himself because he didn't want to be remembered as the one who got killed by a woman. So it might be a little bit of that, just like. And then just a little bit of spite in the text, but the only thing that you remember from the guy is that he was killed by a woman.
And it's one of those things where, you know, with it being still such a problem in today's age, it's hard for me to just come out forwardly and say, you know, suicide is weakness. But it is. And it's a thing you do when you don't feel you have any options left, and the only option left to you is to take full control over the reality that you hate your life and you don't want to try and make it better because you've given up. And it's an outburst and it's an impulse and it's a terrible, terrible, devastating, awful thing. And it sucks. And I wish people didn't have to get there. But in the case of Saul, I would describe it as pathetic and blasphemous or sacrilegious, right? Because he's saying, screw God, screw his plan. What I wanted, I can't actualize. And if I can't actualize it, then there's no place for me on this planet because I'm just not interested in living in a world that doesn't give me what I want at an egotistical level. And that's pathetic, right?
Is it though possible that he accepted he was wrong and wanted to just instead of continuing fighting to just end himself then and there? I'm not sure the text indicated any of that, but
Well,
if
there's always
it
better options. There's always better options than, you know, offing yourself. If he
sure.
truly actually made the revelation that like everything I've done has been, you know, horrible and I've screwed all these people over, the next step wouldn't be to just, you know, take the coward's way out. It'd be to do something about your mistakes. It'd be to try to atone for them. 'Cause like Will says, like as someone who's actually struggled with that kind of stuff, thinking about suicide and like the whole thing in general, it is a weakness. And that is what people need to hear that are struggling with that. And the strength does exist inside you. So, you know, that doesn't have to be anything religious involved. Just know that human beings are equipped with anything.
Yeah, and it's like, no, not today, not ever.
Yeah,
And
not
yeah,
today.
myself as well, you know, like I've been down that road and there's no flowers there. And yeah, you can't just tap out. There's no second round. Not to my knowledge. Maybe there is, but from what I've been told, you don't even get into that second round if you take that way out.
The last thing I wanted to add from this First Samuel is kind of at the very end of it in chapter 28. Saul is talking to a medium and they summon Samuel's ghost.
Yeah.
And it'd be really curious if that happened any later point in the Bible where they are able to summon Saul's ghost. So we'll have to see if that ever manifests again, if we see any other mediums in the Bible. I'm going to keep my eye out for them.
One last thing I want to say is that, you know, if Saul could have got out of himself and it with everyone, if you can just shut your story off and get back to reality and set aside your emotion and logic, you might notice that your biggest enemy could be an even bigger ally, and you might be able to serve them with grace, and you might be able to work together with them with grace. But until we can detach from our emotions, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't have emotions. Emotions are great things. They're good guideposts, but they're not the whole picture, and that's the problem. Exactly. It's like the Pirate's Code, you know, you can't follow it entirely, but it is good to have some guideposts.
More like guidelines, I'd say.
Exactly. And it's like, just settle the heck down and accept reality and see what you can do to make it better.
Well, it's a good time to end. So, you know, we've been talking for over an hour, so hopefully, you know, we touched on the Bible at least a little bit instead of just rambling about politics the whole time. But we'll find out in the editing process, and our viewers will figure it out on their own. But, you know, with that, don't forget to check us out at our website at bookwave.club, and may the force be with you.
Or equal to mass times acceleration.
Poof, poof.
Treat yourself good.
Beautiful.